I'm Alex Dowding. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April 21st, 1993. I have a sponsor. I sponsor guys. And my home group is the Buford Road Group. We meet Wednesdays at 7 p.m. in Bonaire, the south side area of Richmond. So if you're down that way, some of the folks here have been there. Please come by. And we like our meeting a lot. Much like this one, it's a little bit cozy. Yeah, we don't have 150 people at our meeting, but we kind of like it that way. I'd like to thank Hillbilly for asking me to come. And y'all might think that's an insult, but if he calls you, your caller ID, if you have caller ID, it puts last name first. So I feel okay calling him that. He's never asked me not to. So anyway, but thanks for that. And I'd like to thank Bob for riding up with me. And he did the directions by memory, and it was a beautiful drive on the way up here. That was great. The sort of charge or what we're asked to do when we get asked to speak, a lot of people open up in a couple of different ways, but what I like to say is that actually is in not the big book, but another piece of literature that it says when it comes our turn to speak at an AA meeting, we try to share our experience with Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I really hope to do. I can recount most of what I can remember before I got to AA, and I try not to interject too many opinions into it, and I'll try to stick to that. I'm mostly from Richmond, and grew up there for most of my childhood. Very warm, loving, affectionate, caring family. I've got one sister who's 3 years younger than I am, and neither my parents or my sister is or was alcoholic. So I didn't come to you or on the way to you with an example of what it would look like to be an alcoholic. You know, there was always alcohol in the house. I knew where the liquor cabinet was. I watched, you know, Mom have wine, Dad have a gin and tonic. It was just no big deal. So it wasn't. I didn't learn anything as far as excessive drinking or alcoholism from my upbringing. And they were awesome parents. I had most of what I wanted and certainly everything that I needed. And, they were always trying to help me out. They were always trying to do things for me and my sister and nice neighborhoods. And Dad took jobs. And, you know, we moved prior to arriving in Richmond for the sake of the family. So they, you know, everything they did really in a lot of ways was for us. So I've got great opportunity to grow up and to be responsible and respectable and do some things, but didn't turn out that way. And growing up for me, and the longer I've stayed sober, I can see things a little bit differently. It's not like my past has changed, but sort of my impression of my past to a degree has changed. And I did not feel like the guy on the outside looking in growing up. I mean, I had friends in the neighborhood. We did stuff. We, you know, hung out, that kind of thing. But I'm not going to list them all to you, but there's a run of events in my younger life before I got to alcohol that, you know, were in some ways alcoholic without the alcohol. And, you know, getting brought home by the police when you're 11 years old on your birthday is not really normal. You know, getting in a little bit of trouble, you know, the neighbor catches you, you know, putting the thing on the front steps and ringing the doorbell or something, but you know, that kind of thing, and being you know, visited by the Southern Railway detectives because they wanted to know why you were the one that shot that pellet gun at the caboose, you know, that kind of thing. And there were a few other incidents like that that went on, but they just, you know, as soon as they showed up, they left. You know, I was forbidden playing with that friend, like when I got the police, brought home by the police on my birthday, and stuff like that. And, yeah, I really didn't think anything of it, but I, you know, made it through the lower grades of school, and in middle school, I can remember middle school and probably the very beginning of high school, I remember I got into collecting beer cans, and this was a big deal back then, and I had about 800 or 900 different ones, and special shelves made and all this. I'd go to conventions, and I was, you know, we'd go to, like, family beach week during the summer. My dad would haul me up to D.C. to the liquor stores because they sold stuff from all over the place, and I'd come back with, like, two cases, every beer different, you know, and I would be like the pusher, you know, middle school kid pushing beer on adults. Drink this because I got to put it on my shelf, you know, and I would push later in my drinking career, you know, the same kind of behavior. I remember at the beach too, stealing before I drank, stealing liquor from my parents and putting it in. My mom used to do a lot of canning, and putting it in the jars and going down to meet these older kids under the pier, you know, to gain acceptance. They would, I was like, you know, I got the liquor. They want to see me, you know, and that's the way it went. And I might have sipped it or something, but I don't ever remember drinking that way. The first time I remember getting drunk was with a couple of friends of mine, and it was there weren't any parents around. It was a single-parent household, and she was working, and we got into some whiskey, and I remember really liking it. I don't remember my life changing on a dime. I just remember, you know, and I didn't experience it and go, this is what they were talking about. I never heard anybody talk about it. You know, it was just, God, this is awesome, you know, and I didn't start drinking like a swine right after that, but, so I got into high school. That was my introduction to alcohol, and then I more or less didn't go through some of the troubles that I had, which really was elementary in the beginning of high school, but or middle school. But I got into high school, and I got on a sports team by 10th grade, and there were parties every weekend. You know, whoever's parents were out of town, the Legion Hall, the empty field, the, you know, behind the air conditioning place, because there's a little parking lot, we'd throw a band up there, that kind of thing. And it was, the drinking age was 18, so it was like really, it wasn't an issue. And I had an instantaneous group of friends from running track, and everybody went to the same place, you know, every weekend. And that's, you know, 4, 5, 6 beers, catch a buzz. And that was about it. Never really got into a whole lot of trouble in high school. You know, I'm sure I probably puked once or twice and overdid it or whatever, but it was just everybody was kind of doing that, you know, or it seemed like everybody was doing it. Not later in life, like sitting in the bars and really overdoing it, but it's just a lot of people were drinking. And the turning point of my drinking, without question, I got to the end of high school, and I had no game plan. I had no, I want to be this, or I want to go into that, or whatever. It was just, I liked running, and that was about all I could tell you. And so getting near the end of high school, my father said, you know, it would be a really great idea if you went to college. And I said, oh, okay, great. You know, I'll apply some places. And you know, one of them let me in, and off I went. And it was like, you know, if you have a reading lamp or something, and you can kind of see your way around the room, then if you hit all the lights, it was that drastic of a difference going from high school to college, like instantly. You know, life just... And it was a field day. You know, it was not having parental oversight. I don't remember if they changed the drinking age by then, but we got grandfathered in or whatever. And it was just pretty much nonstop party. You know, so we went from having some parties to almost everything was a party. And I lived on a floor with a strange mixture of people that I would end up in one of a couple of different rooms. But it was, you know, you had the pot smokers, and you could identify them by the towel under the door. You know? And then you had the real beer drinkers who usually had, like, some cutout of moose head or something like that that they taped to the front of their door, you know, like that. And then you had the Campus Crusade for Christ who was smattered throughout, you know. So it was just kind of this sort of weird collection of folks. And, you know, when I say things took off when I got to college, I mean, I didn't realize it at the time, but it's like I started experiencing a lot of blackouts. You know, I started getting, not sick so I couldn't drink, but I started getting sick a lot. You know, vomiting from drinking is what I mean. I don't mean, you know, becoming under the weather. I would wake up with, you know, cuts and bruises and stuff like that and not remember where they came from. You know, I would wake up with charge slips in my pocket from the campus police, from the fire drill or the fire alarm somebody pulled. I lived on a 13-story dorm that had five stories off the sides. It was a lot of people. I don't remember any fire alarm. I was in a complete blackout, you know, and I've got paragraphs of obscenities and charges and all this other stuff, and you know, I'd have to go through before the little judicial board, and it was all just, I kind of looked at it like a joke, you know, and my friends laughed at it, I laughed at it. If you're not kicking me out, this isn't really important. And, you know, that became just a regular way of living, you know, challenge drinking and getting up in each other, you know, just sit around and watch TV and trade shots, you know, or other stuff. And, you know, night after night after night of doing that stuff. Now, I was still running, and I think that kept me in school because I had to be at practices and meets and travel and stuff like that. But after about, I guess, 2 years of that, almost 2 years of that, I just couldn't hold it together anymore. And, I couldn't make it to class. I couldn't do my assignments. I couldn't study for tests. I couldn't do any of that stuff, but I didn't see that at the time. It was just like, I hate that econ professor. I hate, you know, this. I hate that. I would meet with them and make up excuses of why these things weren't done. And, you know, it just didn't even register that drinking was getting in the way of that at all, you know. And I'd seen some other people leave school. You know, we all saw them, or some of us saw them. You know, they'd get there, and they're gone immediately. And if I hadn't have been running, that probably would have been me. I don't doubt that for a minute. You know, when I left there, I had to sit out, and I thought, you know, I kind of had to take the hit for my parents and endure the lecture and look at what was going on and that kind of thing, or pretend I was looking at what was going on. And so I got a job, and, you know, the drinking didn't change from what I was doing at school. And at the time, that was a little bit of a surprise. But I just started hanging out with people that did the same stuff, like attracts like, you know. And I was working a retail job for a one-man band, you know, owner of this store, and real great guy, gave me a lot of opportunity, and I completely screwed him over. And he would work and then leave, and I would be like the afternoon night guy, and I started embezzling money from him, and I started drinking on the job, and I started having my friends come up there while I was drinking on the job and hiding them in the back. And I remember one time him coming up there with his wife, and he'd stop in from time to time to see how business had been, you know, what's it looking like, and I've, like, just chugged a beer or taken a hit of Wild Turkey or something, I don't remember what it was, and I've got one of my friends passed out in the back, and I'm like, just don't go back there, you know, and he never said a word. I don't know if he knew that or not. And what ended up happening with that job while I was sitting out, trying to save money, was I came in one day and he confronted me that there was somebody tried to return something that there was no record of it being sold, you know, and I'm on the spot, and I wasn't brought up that way, and it's not, you know, I did it, there's no question about it, you know, but what I didn't tell you is there was a beer and wine import store next door, and a Chinese food place there. So I was eating and drinking and kind of doing it that way. But I didn't associate that I had, you know, I did that. The alcohol did not make me do that. I'm 100% responsible for that. But I did not associate me changing with the alcohol that I would do something like that. So, you know, he helped he never turned me into the police and didn't hold it over my head, but I had to pay him back. And, you know, that started really what would become, for a handful of years, me drinking, trying to find a job, trying to find a place out of my parents' house, trying to hold it together, trying to go back to school, giving my dad the speech. You know, I've seen what it's like. I realize how much I don't want to be in this situation and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I'd go back, take two classes instead of full time. I mean, it was a joke. I can remember sitting in an econ class at VCU, and happy hour became more important than the econ class because I saw a guy that I knew in high school that was in that class. You know, we weren't even all that good of a friends. But they had a CD jukebox, and that was new. You know, and it was happy hour. So I quit, you know. The only thing I learned was withdrawal before I took an F. I almost refused to think about it. I didn't associate the drinking at all with the inability or the failure of being able to complete anything. You know, so that just kept going. A religion class I took at University of Richmond, same thing. I'd show up drunk to class. You know, and then I would be too drunk to go to class. So why try? Just get drunk. You know, and that's what happened. While all this is going on, I mean, this isn't, you know, from one week to the next. I mean, I'm drinking pretty much continuously. But these events that I listed are kind of spread out. You know, and in between, I'm getting in a little bit of trouble here and there. I got in a pretty bad car accident that probably should have gotten my attention. It didn't. You know, that one I wasn't driving. Lots of times pulled over for drunk driving, lots of times walking away from it, you know, and years just kept rolling by, you know, and where I kind of ended up from all of that, before I get right to the end of my drinking, was it was clear to me that there was something going on negative in my life, because I could look at people that I knew and still had a semi-relationship with on occasion that I went to high school with that had moved on, graduated or started their own business or worked their way up here or did whatever and bought a house, kids are coming, stuff's happening, life, you know, and occasionally I'd get invited to something and I'd see it firsthand. Well, what are you doing? Make up some story. It was clear I had fallen behind the curve. You know, that was really the clearest indication I had that my life was screwed up, other than whatever was in my hands at that moment, which wasn't much. That bothered me. And, you know, I kind of started to develop this idea that if, and I probably should have mentioned, I did grow up going to church, Presbyterian. I went until I didn't have to go anymore, which was probably around the age of 17. And that was that. I never put anything into it. I never got anything out of it. That was pretty much the story. And but I had started to develop this idea in my head that, you know, life really was like a lottery, and that if I had the right circumstances presented to me, that I would just grow up. I would seize upon the opportunity to mature in an instant and move forward and capitalize on whatever it was going to, you know, it wasn't a lottery like I'm going to get a bunch of money. It was just, I'm going to be presented with the opportunity to grow up and be responsible, and it's going to happen, you know. And so I kind of held on to that thing, and the way that looked to me was how I would seize upon it would be that I would have a driver's license, I would have insurance, I would be out of my parents' house, I would have a decent job, I would have time to exercise, and a couple of dates. And that's all I'm asking for, and my life will change, you know. And towards the end of my drinking, I had all those things in my life. And I was sitting by a window in my bedroom on the floor listening to my clock radio, smoking cigarettes and drinking whatever the Schaefer's or Milwaukee's Best or whatever, you know, beer after beer to get myself to sleep. You know, and by that time, the only thing that I had, the only real peace in my life was if I could pass out, if I could go down, and I knew I could insulate myself from consequences because I wasn't out. I couldn't go to bars anymore. You know, I wasn't into the drinking, and I did a lot of drinking and driving, and I enjoyed it for a long time. But I knew something was going to explode if I got in that car. It didn't mean I never did it again. It just didn't happen as frequently. So I'd just sit and drink warm beer, cold beer. It didn't matter. You know, and pass out in a heap. And a lot of people had started to mention things to me, family members, some friends. I found out some more details later about some planned interventions that never took off and that kind of thing. I think that would have been kind of funny. But I ended up... I had been introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of really a lawyer's advice on a DUI. And what he said to me was, if you go to AA, it's going to look good to the judge. And I'm like, I am there. And I'm kind of overlapping time here, but that was middle 20s. And I said, okay. And I went... 24 years old, couldn't drive, had to be dropped off by my mom, you know, real good for the image. And unfortunately, the meeting that I went to, some of the meetings you could smoke in then, but this wasn't one of them, so everybody was outside before the meeting, so they would seem like, I remember, a nice little audience when I arrived. There's the new guy. And, you know, I hated having to do that. But I'm just hoping it would score points with the lawyer. And everybody was nice. And, you know, the meeting actually was okay. Don't remember what was said. Remember two people that were there. And that was about it. And then sort of covering the time period that I skipped, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous from about the age 24 to 28, a dozen or more times. I mean, I don't even remember how many. Never staying sober more than 30 days. Never understanding anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. What really was happening here. I was completely inconsiderate of anything and anybody. If I showed up, I wasn't on time. I'm not sure that I ever left early, but I know I showed up late a lot. You know, I'd roll into the parking lot with the windows down, and whatever music I had playing, it was loud. you know, to draw attention to myself, or just like somebody's going to come over and go, oh, that's awesome. Can we be with you because of what you were playing? Idiot, you know, but that's what I was doing. So I had been to AA meetings and stuff and that kind of thing. You know, I was still stuck with that idea that I'd be provided this opportunity. And I went to an AA meeting April 17th, 1993. Stayed for the whole meeting. Left. Went on a 3-day drunk. And woke up with my roommate yelling at me. This is a guy who I love and have for a long time. We've been friends since, I guess, probably the beginning of high school. And he said something to me. You know, and at the time, it wasn't my own situation was what was the worst. It wasn't the words that he was using. But I look back, nobody ever said this to me that I can remember. He said, if you don't do something, you're going to die. You know, and I'm like, it was clear that I needed to do something. And it was clear that I'd been to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was clear that I was still drinking. 1 + 1 = AA doesn't work. And, you know, that's how I felt about it. So I had recently gotten a job that I still have today. I decided that because AA didn't work, couldn't go to inpatient, I would lose my job. So I went to I just looked a lady up in the phone book over at St. Mary's and went to see her. And the next day, and she said, you got to go to AA meetings. You know. It just didn't seem fair at all. So I went back to AA, and I was kind of stupid because I never figured out that you could move around to AA meetings. It's like I'd get drunk and come back to the same meetings. And the worst thing I hated was having to get up and get the white chip in front of the people that were there every time I came back. But it never dawned on me. Go somewhere else, dummy. You know, it was... I was just stupid. But the, I went to the meeting and I got up to get my chip and that's the part I hated the most. I mean, I just felt so embarrassed and humiliated, and I got up there and there's this guy, Randy, and I knew him, and they were out of white chips. You know? And it literally seemed like 15 minutes that he's trying to figure out what to do, and it was probably 10 seconds. He pulled a quarter out of his pocket and gave it to me as the white chip because they were out of them, you know. But it's, go back to my seat. And, you know, and I had no earthly idea that date would be my sobriety date because I didn't come in here any different than I had any other time. I was under pressure. This time it wasn't legal yet. But it was the same old song and dance. And I didn't have a problem going to AA meetings until I drank. So I believe wholeheartedly that AA meetings are an important part of my sobriety. And the guys that I work with are an important part of their sobriety. I went to plenty of meetings and I didn't stay sober. You know, so it's a bigger package than that, for sure. But I just ambled along like I'd always done, hung out with the loud people, you know, and I kind of had I was talking to my neighbor. Her son I'd seen him at a meeting and he got a DUI and stuff. And I said, you know, I totally understand where he's sitting because I felt the same way. I'm like in no man's land. You know, here I am at this age and there's like a bunch of people or some younger than I am and a whole bunch of them older than I am. And here I am in the middle. You know, where's my crowd? You know, and that's kind of how I felt. But, you know, I just kept going to meetings and doing that kind of thing. And I finally met this girl and we started like talking and having coffee and doing this kind of stuff. And I kind of had a sponsor. Well, I didn't have a sponsor. I had a guy that I called or I'd whine to or hold hostage in the Friendly's parking lot after the meeting, that kind of stuff. But I was way more interested in her than I was in this AA thing or any kind of sponsorship. And I never asked him to sponsor me. So I'm kind of following her around because I became interested in that. And she goes to this big book meeting. And, I didn't think kindly of that. I didn't think it was necessary. I didn't want to go. But it became her, go to the meeting, and I can be around her, or don't go, and I'm not around her. Of course I went to the meeting, So I go to this meeting, and the important part of that is that it was the fourth dimension at Rebos in Richmond at the time. And it was a very odd assortment of people at this meeting. And I sat in there, and I can remember sitting in there and listening to people share. And this one guy in particular who would become my sponsor, I don't know what it was. It was just a lot of it was probably me. Some of it was probably a little bit circumstance. But I never thought I had heard somebody talk like that before. I mean, it was like a completely different language in regards to recovery. And, what ended up happening there is that I got to the point where I got into whatever, however many times it was, more than a dozen, probably less than 30. When I'm sitting in an AA meeting and I know I'm going to drink, I'm gone. When I leave here, I'm headed to the Amoco or I'm going to the Sev or I'm wherever I'm going to get whatever I'm going to get, that's what's happening as soon as I leave here. I'm not going to leave early and draw attention to myself. I'll just slip out. And I knew that's what was happening. And, I went up with some prodding to talk to this guy, and I told him that. And I remember, as my recollection goes, saying, because they talked a lot about steps in this big book meeting. I was like, I don't know if I've ever done a first step. I don't know if I've ever done a second step. I don't know. Kind of out of the mouths of babes, it couldn't have been more true. I had no idea. Obviously, I'd done nothing, but I had no idea about any of this. He sat and talked with me, agreed to sponsor me, and we kind of took it from there. And without that, there's absolutely zero question. Now, he could have been somebody else delivering the same thing. But without that, there's absolutely no question I wouldn't be standing here. That I don't personally say that he saved my life. It's that kind of member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Without that, I would not be here. And he took a lot of time with me. And he intimidated me, too, because he really seemed to know what he was talking about. And I obviously didn't know jack. And he started asking me to do things and get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and go to these meetings. Hey, we're going to this conference and listen to this tape. And then I would get a quiz on what was on the tape. And he wouldn't call it a quiz. He would just ask me questions. and stuff like that. And, I mean, he went a long way toward making me accountable without, handed me a checklist of this is what you had to do. He always seemed to call it. At the time, I would have said the wrong time, but just at the right time. He always said just the right thing. I mean, it was, what was happening is I was becoming open to Alcoholics Anonymous and had never been before. And he was sharing his experience with me. He took me through the steps, and which I'd never done before, not even remotely. Had no idea what I was doing. I remember a couple of things with that. One being the fifth step, and the first three steps really weren't a big deal to me. It wasn't like obvious alcohol was battering me. You want to call me alcoholic? I got no problem with it. Is that what it's called? that's fine. The label fits. I can't not drink. I can't control the drinking. I need something beyond myself to be able to, do something with this situation. You want to call it God? That's fine. No problem. Make a decision to go through with the rest of the steps. That's okay, too. The fourth step, I'm lazy. I'm a procrastinator. I don't remember him letting me go on too long, but the point in getting to that was I was extremely intimidated about doing this fifth step. I did not look at it. It wasn't hard to do. I'm just lazy. But I was like, I got to sit down with this guy and read this stuff to him. And a lot of it I didn't mind. You know, I embezzled from somebody. I wasn't proud of that, but for some reason that flowed out of my mouth a lot easier than, like, some of the sexual secrets, for example. You know, it was just there. And I went into this fifth step with two or three or four things, I don't even remember now, that I hadn't even written down. And so we sat down, and he didn't pull them out of me or any such thing, but it was kind of like in the magic of the moment, those were the first things out of my mouth. And I had not intended on saying them. The rest of it was a piece of cake. You know, I was still nervous. I was always nervous. You know, but I certainly felt a lot more comfortable. And I couldn't, you know, I'm getting through the sort of redundant stuff, and I'm still thinking to myself while I'm reading this to him, I can't believe I just told this guy. You know, and there's a whole lot of stuff going on at his house at times. The pipes burst and the wife to be's in and out and the animals and all this other mess. It was like a circus. But that was really the first thing I ever did in Alcoholics Anonymous. Really. You know, I mean, I'd help put some chairs away. I'd done it. That stuff's important. But, I mean, I'd never really done anything in AA. It's not like I'd been through the steps and then drank again. I'd never done this. I got a tremendous sense, not immediately, but shortly thereafter, a tremendous sense of being a part of Alcoholics Anonymous after doing that. And, like, I belong here, like, this is where I'm supposed to be, AA is home, whatever you want to call it. How it appeared to me at the time is, you know, I'm not having to sit on both of my hands anymore because I'm shaking and nervous. And I don't even think I sweated in that meeting. You know, I'm looking forward to going to that, you know, it showed up in small, simple ways, but that was kind of the effect. And, you know, another really sort of interesting point of going through the steps for the first time is when we got, you know, we got through the rest of the steps and all that, and up to step 10. And I kind of felt like the, I don't know, it's like you're jettisoning off something, like a little dinghy or something out on the big lake or something like that. It's like, you know, I'm not under my sponsor's wing anymore. I got a sponsor. I get to ask him questions. I have to call him, you know, see him at meetings and events and stuff. But it's like, I've been helped all the way up to this point, almost handheld. You know, now I got to start doing this stuff. And I was really, kind of felt like I didn't, you know, oh, God, this is going to be different. And I remember being very, very thankful about the directions, specifically in the 10th and 11th step, that were very simple and very easy for me to digest. I could, you know, go there, press that button, put it in that, you know, that kind of stuff I could digest. And, you know, I remember thinking to myself, hopefully, you know, I can do this. You know, it wasn't some kind of, you know, ethereal, smoky, not really sure what that is. It was laid out in black and white, and that you know, I could swallow that. And, you know, so that's what I started doing. And, you know, it was a while before the, before I really sponsored anybody. Like, maybe a couple of years. And I remember, you know, that seemed to bother some people more than it bothered me. And before that sounds kind of conceited, I don't mean it that way. I was putting my hand out, and I was asking, you know, trying to put myself in positions to do that. It just wasn't working out, you know. And some of that, I'm sure, was my newness, but it just the luck of the draw. That was the way God intended it to be, I suppose, you know. But I kept plugging, and you know, I remember the first guy that I got, and I was, you know, so excited to get him to inventory. You know, I was over at his girlfriend's apartment. just with him, and we went over, you know, the book and did the third step together and all this stuff, and I showed him how to write the four-step stuff, and I went back to do the fifth step, and, you know, and I think I had to, like, I had some appointments somewhere. I don't even remember where, but, like, I came in off the interstate and went there, and, you know, scheduled time. I go to the door, and I'm not sure if I hear noise behind the door or not, but I knock on the door, there's no answer. You know, I knock again, there's no answer. I hear some scuttling inside. And I'm like, damn it, I know he's home. You know, open the door. We got to do this. You're robbing me, you know. And they never opened the door, you know. I never saw him again. But, you know, but that was kind of my first attempt. And you know, it just, when it was ready, it started. And people started appearing in my life and being in front of me. And all along the way, I wasn't doing anything different. I mean, I've always had a home group. You know, I've always had a sponsor. I've always had commitments. I've always participated in other events. You know, all that stuff was going on. And, you know, then you get a pile of them, and it's like, well, God, why was I asking for that? You know? And it's, I mean, nothing like my wife, but sometimes it's kind of interesting. You know, I've gone through some ups and downs in sobriety, dry spots, rough patches, whatever you want to call it, but I am absolutely convinced of a couple of things. And one is that I'm very, very fortunate to have a sponsor that is actually a part of my life and not a name or just a long-distance phone number or anything like that. And usually, most everything is fairly smooth, but usually when it's not, it will begin like this. Not with a list of instructions for me, I need to go do this and this and this, but it'll be a suggestion. And my immediate reaction is, I ain't doing that. I don't want to do that. Yeah, my plate is so full, not going to happen. You know, not out of my mouth. That's what's going on in my head. You know, but really what I've come to find out, I don't fight a lot of the responsibility in AA. I don't do it begrudgingly. It's not really a chore at all. But when it comes down to this other stuff, you know, there's still a resistance in me that doesn't want to go above and beyond and do what somebody else is asking me to do. The sort of prize is, though, when I'm willing, which is most of the time, nearly all the time eventually, you know, I gain some kind of understanding or I get put in a different position because of that willingness. You know, but I'm still resistant, you know, to do things that I don't necessarily want to do. But without that relationship with the sponsor, that stuff wouldn't be happening. You know, and I mean, it's, you know, I'm still very alcoholic. You know, it says we're not cured, and I'm not cured. And it ain't just the alcohol. You know, it's my nutty mind. There are a lot of things, other things that have gone on. In my sobriety, I got married to that girl, for example, and we did everything possible that you could do wrong, totally. Steamrolled over each other people, lived together a couple of times, threw her out, she did this, da-da-da, all this other stuff, and, you know, the only possibility of anything ever happened was when there was no possibility of anything happening. You know, and that's the point I had to arrive at. You know, that I wasn't going to be able to manufacture this or fix it into getting better. You know, and this time around, it actually happened on its own rather than by one of my little tentacles, which I was famous for, especially in relationships. You know, and that's been another awesome part of my sobriety because I am a loner. You know, I absolutely, don't take this the wrong way, but I mean, left to my own, I would be by myself all the time. Not that I don't like being around people, not that things aren't fun or I don't enjoy doing things, but if you kind of let me wither, I'm going to be by myself, not around you, or anybody else for that matter. And one of the things, excuse me, is, you know, being married to somebody in AA, and it's just a benefit for me, is there's AA going on in my house round the clock all the time. You know, so it's right there, and there's really no escaping it. And if I don't do something, this doesn't get utilized as much, but it crosses my mind. If I don't do something, or I don't go to my meetings, or, you know, return the phone call, or take care of a responsibility, somebody's asking me, why not? You know, frankly, I'd rather go ahead and do it than get asked that question. You know, and that's some of the time, not all of the time. So it's just like a built-in, almost a protective environment. We've got other AA people around us in our neighborhood, too, which is just awesome, you know. And maybe God knows that I'd be, you know, out of here or something. I don't know. So, but I'm thankful for those situations. When I was trying to sort of control my life and get things in line and then finally tried to get sober and then finally got sober, I don't think that, I'm not sure that I would be standing here if I hadn't gotten help from my parents, and particularly from my dad. I wouldn't call them enablers, although I'm sure some of that went on to a degree, but, you know, he did a lot for me and had a lot to do supportively for me being able to get sober. And he passed away in June, this past June, and it was fairly quick. He went down in about 6 weeks. Cancer all over his body. And at one point during my the debauchery years, he had written this letter to me that outlined, and I shared this at his funeral. It had in much brief version, more brief version. But he'd outlined, written this letter to me and outlined how much he loved me, blah, you know, the typical stuff. And then at the end, he said, you know, the answer that you're seeking, I'm paraphrasing here because I don't remember exactly what it said, but the answer that you're seeking, you're going to have to find in God. You know, and I remember reading that and throwing that crap away. You know, like, man, this is like a stake through the heart. You know, and the funny thing is, he was absolutely right. Absolutely right. You know, and I didn't seek out to have a relationship with God like that. But as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's what I ended up with. And I'm absolutely thankful for it. You know, and because of AA, I could be there while he was going through this process when otherwise I wouldn't have been able to take that. Hospitals, nursing homes, in the bed at home, you know, all this for my mom and my sister and all this stuff, and it all went really smoothly. But the neatest thing about it, in my own perspective, was, remember I said I'm a loner, really, was I had no idea how much I needed the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, while I was going through this, people did things for me, and I asked some of them to do it and let or whatever, other things, but what I got out of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous was an entirely different channel than I had experienced before. You know, not just because somebody brought this over, not just because it was the whole package. Can't really put my finger on it, but it impressed upon me how fortunate I am, and also how much I need to be a part of this fellowship. It's not just about coming to meetings and keeping some commitments, you know, but really being involved in other people's lives and in their time of need, trying to be there for them, which, you know, on paper I would do anyway, but it's just a completely different perspective. The other thing that really has been interesting recently, My wife and I faced a decision. I have no children of my own. I have a stepson, Nicholas, who will turn 18 October 1st. I've known him since he was 2 years old. Like to remind him I changed some of his diapers on occasion, remind him of that. And he, from probably, I think third grade, either third or fourth grade, he went to school from our house. So while his dad was still alive. And his dad passed away a little over 2 years ago. But he came to us with an idea that he wanted to go spend his senior year of high school in Germany. That's funny, you know. Whatever. That's pretty much what we said. And then he came back and said, I've been accepted into this program. And it was like, crap, we got to make a decision. You know, and it's like, only child, and my wife and I talked about that, and it took some time, but the only thing, really the only thing that we could come up with was that, you know what, it would be really entirely selfish of us to tell him he can't do this. This is maybe not the chance of a lifetime, but certainly next door to that, if not that. And so we told him that he could go, and he's over there now. And in fact, he's in Italy right now on some kind of school break or something. But, I mean, I couldn't get him off the computer 2 months ago, out of his room, you know, and then he goes sailing off to Italy. It's just unbelievable. It took a lot of work to get that to happen. Not just getting a passport, not just filling out a form, it was a lot of stuff, and setting up accounts and setting up this and making sure the immunization thing, and then making it work in Germany before he went so they would say it's okay and all this other mess. Sometimes for me it felt like a second job taking care of this. And then he got to Dulles Airport when we dropped him off and lost his wallet. Didn't lose his passport, he lost his wallet. So I got to deal with the bureaus and the, calling TSA and everybody under the sun. We never found it, get every credit card, bank card, all that, driver's license. So dealing with all this stuff, researched, got him the right computer that he needed for school. I mean, just the list is endless. What I'm getting at is, look at all the stuff that I did. Okay, for him to be able to do this, this is what's going on in my mind. And he won't answer one of my emails. I can't get a hold of him when I call language camp. He's now with his host family and stuff like that. And my wife is getting a little irritated with it, too. I mean, we did hear from him and stuff. We knew he got there safely. But it just wasn't the responsibility wheel was not spinning the way that I wanted it to spin. Look at all I've done. But I thought back to what I mentioned about my father. I thought back to, that man did so much for me. And this is really an exercise in self-centeredness and selfishness for me. That guy did so much for me, I probably would be in the thousands of times that I never said thank you, or that I never did this, or I never did that. And I didn't write that out. I didn't, it's just what showed up. And I'm like, I'm dealing with a teenager, that's having the experience, hopefully, of a lifetime. And the difference between loving somebody one way and loving somebody with an attachment, and I just let go of that. It may show back up, we'll see, but it really made when I looked at that type of behavior in my own life, it really gave a different perspective from the way that I live to what's happening. And he's not doing anything wrong whatsoever. He's being a teenager, but I hold, I tend to hold other people to higher standards than I hold myself sometimes, even though that one was in sort of in retrospect. But that's all going well, and you know, I'm pretty much at the end. But I would like to thank y'all for being here, and thanks, Hillbilly, again for asking me to speak. And sure, we'll be back up here sometime soon. Y'all have a reservoir of people around us that you tap sometimes. So I'll be back. Thanks.